We covered implicit bias before on this show when I spoke with Michelle Puckett about working with implicit racism as white folks. Today we come to the subject again with the kind and insightful Chris Burkeen. Chris is a writer and internet celebrity of sorts, which is to say he has a firm following and a very popular blog and Facebook page. I'm a huge fan of Chris, and as a woman, I often wish I could pull him out of my pocket to advocate for me when I'm in a situation where I'm naming sexism and being met with fragile masculinity in the form of gaslighting or the notorious "not all men" refrain. In this episode, Chris shares his journey of waking and how he has cultivated awareness of the intersections of his experiences of both privilege and marginalization. He speaks from his own experience, sharing how he regulates himself in online interactions by taking people in good faith, while also not policing the reactions of others. Largely, he talks about the ongoing work of noticing, whether it's his own or others' privilege or marginalization, and being open and willing to learn. He also shares some excellent guidance for anyone who has found themselves thrust into the spotlight of internet fame, emphasizing, possibly unsurprisingly, the importance of self-care when it comes to the balancing act of your personal and private life, and the responsibility that comes from having an online following. Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for being on the show.
It's nice to be here.
Fantastic. So to start off, what I've been asking all of my guests is to tell me just a bit about their experience when they were growing up and at the point that they started to have a sense of wanting to be of benefit for a greater social good. That could be named a lot of ways. When you started to see yourself as an activist, when you started to become socially aware.
Right. I think there's always been kind of a thread of this going through my life. My mom raised me by herself. She got a little bit of help from my stepdad when I was about six. He came along. And, you know, she was kind of a staunch feminist. So I think a lot of the groundwork was laid there, but, you know, I spent quite a bit of time in my, I guess, 20s and maybe early 30s, sort of being, I guess, what we would call on the internet, like a dude bro, you know, sort of like both sides, you know, kind of arguing philosophically against, hardcore feminism or something like that. It's been a long journey of, kind of waking up to my privilege and my fragility and the ways in which the scripts we learn, you know, the sort of auto responses are set about to protect things like patriarchy. There's this joke on the internet behind every, I think it's woke man. I don't like to use that word for myself, but this is the joke. It's behind every woke man, there are several exhausted feminists. And it is so true. There were so many people who were just inexhaustibly patient with me for so long. And if I have come to any point that is admirable, it is not because of myself. It's because of them and their willingness to gently educate and, you know, and then also sometimes just yell at me so that I had to go away and think about things. I think the moment that I crossed a Rubicon, it's sort of a, I don't know, I mean, I'm not super famous or anything, but it, as far as people who know who I am go, it is one of the most popular moments of my sort of internet existence. I blogged about it, and that blog became super viral. I was writing the BART, and I was watching a guy hit on a woman who clearly wanted nothing to do with him, and I kind of started hitting on him, and I blogged about it. And the replies that came into that on that blog through Facebook and through the blog itself and in emails just kind of, it kind of shattered this preconception that I had that this was not that big a deal. Like, it was a big deal, but not a huge deal. It just blew the doors off of that. And I really started to realize that just having these stories one by one, just pouring in, thousands of them literally, woke me up to this idea that harassment was so common and these, the dynamics gender dynamics were so prevalent that I just hope that I can undo some of my trashier years is really what I'm trying to do. Kind of redeem myself for my 20s, essentially. If that makes sense.
It does.
I keep thinking back to this moment. I was very young, and my stepdad was, we were camping, and he was trying to kind of teach me the philosophy of campsites. He's like, you don't just pick up your own trash, you try to find a few others, you know, so you can just leave the world a little bit better than you found it. And that's what I hope I'm sort of trying to do.
It's a good philosophy. I like that analogy.
Yeah.
I think we probably all spend a lot, like by the time we reach our 30s, spend a lot of time redeeming for things of our 20s. So intersectionality, it's a word that gets bandied out a lot these days. And I think it's one of those ones that's starting to become a bit numb in people's consciousness. But I think it's also really valuable because no one experiences the world 100% privileged or 100% marginalized. So the point is, like, our identity shapes our view of the world.
Right.
Could you share a little bit about how you currently identify? Because I think that's another thing, is that our identity changes over time and shifts. So, yeah, if you could talk a bit about how you currently identify and then how you see that informing your views and your experience of the world.
Oh, wow. Well, I think the most important identification that is sort of fundamental to my experiences of the world is that as far as passing goes, I pass as almost as very, very privileged. If you kind of pop the hood and look under the hood a little bit, you know, you're going to find a few things that are a little bit skewy. I have pretty bad ADD, and ethnically, I'm technically Jewish and I'm not straight. But I pass as white and cis and het and male, and there is a lot of passing privilege. And I think that would be the most important starting point, is that I've walked through life clearly privileged in almost every way that there is an axis that we examine. And I try to keep that in mind when I'm amplifying people's voices and in an encounter where I need to shut up and listen, things like that.
That leads to a pretty good question, I guess, about shutting up and listening and amplifying voices. I mean, I consider you to be an ally, and previously there was an episode with Lynn Langill where she talks about allyship, and one of my favorite things that I like to say that I learned from her is being an ally is like being cool. If you claim the label for yourself, then it's probably not true.
Yes.
So what have you learned about being an ally and knowing when to speak up and knowing when it's time to shut up and listen?
Yeah. Not enough. I'll say that for sure. I totally agree with you. I think it's like a nickname or a dream catcher. You can't call yourself that, and I don't refer to myself that way. But what I do, I mean, I think it's always important to listen, and it's always important to be aware of the intersections and the power dynamics that are going on, you know. And if you're having a conversation about the latest Marvel show, then of course you are fine to participate. But if you're having a conversation about whether we should be using the label bisexual or pansexual,
yeah,
you know, then it's time to just listen, you know, take a seat. And I try really hard mostly to just listen. And then when I'm amplifying, I try to do so across whatever axis we're talking about. So, like, I'm not going to tell a woman how to be a feminist, even if something that is happening is pinging my radar as internalized misogyny. That's not my place. You know, who I'm going to talk to is other men. I'm going to say, hey, guys, we can't do this, or we should do this, or whatever. Does that answer your question, or am I?
Yeah, no, I think that's really good. It's very clear. And I really appreciate what you say about it being a process, because I think that that's another, and this is a huge part of activist communities, is this sense of woke versus not woke, which I think is very problematic, because there's a lot of dualism there, and it just falls into that like rigidness. You're either, you've arrived or you haven't, and right. It really is a process, right?
It's absolutely,
yeah. So what sort of things, like, how do you go about learning from failing? Because I think that's a very difficult practice for anyone.
Yeah,
because generally when we fail, we feel like, oh my god, I totally messed up, I'm a terrible person, and that in itself is actually kind of a as someone who carries a lot of that around, I'm like, but it also is like so much about me. It's like such an ego trip.
Yeah.
Even though I don't necessarily see it that way, like, I know that it is. So yeah, what's your process of learning from failing?
I think the most important, the thing I noticed, I won't say most important. The thing I noticed the most is it hurts. you know, it really stinks when you, can I say fuck up?
Go ahead.
All right. It really, I don't know what kind of podcast we're doing here. It really stings when you fuck up, you know, and you get called out or called in, you know, and somebody is like, this was really way out of line, you know, and you have to think about that. That process in itself, I think, is also in the same way, you know, listening to that can sort of deprogram something that you've done wrong. The process itself on a larger scale sort of deprograms you to the whole idea that you need to move through the world without ever making any mistakes. And by the, God, I almost said 10th, but it's really more like, you know, the 100th call out. You're like, okay, you know, my ego is not as bruised from this as maybe the first time when I was apoplectic about having my intentions challenged. And you get better at it, and the whole process gets more smooth. And, you know, there are definitely things that happened, like in the last month or 6 weeks, where, you know, I was just like, oh, you're right, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, where 10 years ago, I would have switched to my laptop with the ergonomic keyboard because I was going to write 53 paragraphs about why I'm not a bad person, you know. Yeah, and you just get better at it over time. But it really does, it really does take, for me, there's a very physical reaction. Mm-hmm. And I have to wait till that's over. Like, I can feel my blood pressure go up. I can feel the flush. I can feel that guilt and shame that I've hurt someone that I didn't mean to. And if I react in that moment, there's about a 99% chance I'm going to regret what I say. So I really have to wait that out. And sometimes I even say, look, I hear you. I just need to wait this out, you know, and I'll get back to you. And, you know, most of the time they're right. Something I said was problematic as hell. And it wasn't that I intended to be hurtful. It was that that was a place in my, you know, worldview that I hadn't examined yet. That took some deprogramming.
I was thinking about what you said about popping the hood.
All right.
And I think there's a very important message there about the fact that a lot of marginalization isn't seen.
Yeah.
And it happens under the surface. And especially when you're talking about something like class.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about childhood trauma, experiences of abuse, mm-hmm. things like that. And then also the different communities that we might be part of, where within that community, there is a range of marginalization experience. So, for example, I'm a queer person, but as a middle-class white woman, I'm going to experience a lot less marginalization than, say, a transgender woman of color.
Yeah.
So what sort of influence do you think being, like, having awareness of that under the hood marginalization has had for you in doing this work?
I think for me, the thing I try to do the most is limit the way I engage with most people as far as call-outs, I guess, go. I try to hip-check people when they're really running a cold privilege script, you know, I don't know how better to say that when it's just really obvious, like this is a mansplaining situation or something like that.
Yeah.
I try to hip check that, and I try to sort of speak to hypothetical, you know, a lot of posts I write start, "Hey, fellow guys or dudes," or "Hey, fellow white people." So that way I'm not policing anybody's identity or challenging them in a way that they might have passing privilege or issues that I don't know about or something like that. I think there are a lot of important conversations in social justice going on right now about how maybe effective it can be to be quite so confrontational. And I don't necessarily feel like it's my place to take part in those conversations because I do carry so much privilege and even more passing privilege. I don't want to be the white guy that shows up and, "Yeah, you guys are mean," or something like that. That's way out of line for me. But I do think these conversations are important, and I've noticed some of the people having them are not, they don't look like me, you know, they're not carrying a lot of privilege and such.
The internet, so this is where I see your allyship play out, and where for me, like, I have shared many of your posts directly because I was like, well, here is a white guy saying the thing I just said, but I know you're probably going to read it because he wrote it.
Yeah.
So the internet, it's a complicated space. So I'd like to just riff with you a little bit about the internet as, I don't know, there's a lot of pieces here. There's the fact that, and this is something you've spoken to before, that these conversations are starting to happen. Interestingly, once there was a space in which basically anyone who has access to it can publicly post stuff.
Yeah.
So could you talk, I guess, first a bit about safe spaces online? And what you've learned from watching that and participating in that?
Yeah. I think what I've learned the most from the idea of safe spaces is from the folks who didn't want them to be safe. Like, I learned about their importance by watching people try to invade them, essentially. You know, you get into a space, and it's a space where some people would like to talk about their experiences of the world with a few assumptions in mind, like that something radical like sexism exists, you know.
Yeah, like this is the best fact that we all agree on.
Right. And can we please just skip that part of the conversation and go right on to this next part? And watching, you know, let's take that example. Men show up and say, "Hey, I don't think sexism exists. Can you prove it?" Showed me really how important it was to have spaces where those assumptions did not have to be reasserted for every guy that comes along and decides they want to have a debate. And, you know, the internet's complexity lends itself to that, and I think that's awesome. But it also, like, you can see how entitled folks with privilege can be in those situations, because they think every conversation they walk in on, every community that they are able to access, literally any place they're capable of going online, they feel entitled to start having a conversation about whatever the fundamental truths are. And it's a little weird. It would be like a person walking into an advanced geometry or advanced algebra class and demanding to have imaginary numbers explained to them. And when the teacher says, you know, we're past this, we've done imaginary numbers, here's a textbook, go read it, you know, and they say, no, you have to stop everything you're doing and explain this to me. And when the teacher says, that's not what this class is, we're way past that, the person says, yeah, but the door wasn't locked. You should have locked me out if you wanted to talk about imaginary numbers. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And then also, I mean, and if you had locked them out, then it would be a sense of, well, now you're discriminating against me because you won't let me ask questions about fundamental truths.
It's a double bind, because if you do that, then, you know, you're not rational and open-minded and willing to debate, stuff like that. Even though they could literally click three things and go find all the debate they wanted.
Yeah, well, because it's not really about debate.
Right. That's exactly right. It's not about
another thing about safe spaces, and like a conversation I've had with some people about it, is that a safe space isn't necessarily a comfortable space.
Yeah.
So, for example, you and I having this conversation as white folk and mm-hmm. people who have a certain amount of privilege that we have acknowledged, you know, I can safely have this conversation with you, but I know that we might touch on topics that are uncomfortable. I know that there is always going to be the power dynamic in that you're a cis man and I'm a cis woman. There's that sort of thing. But I think when you're online in creating space to have those uncomfortable conversations, you have that problem of that when you're online, you don't have things like tone of voice and you don't have a lot of the connection and camaraderie that you have when you're talking to people in person, because usually you already have some sort of relationship with them.
Right.
What has been your learning experience and some advice that you can give to people around regulating these conversations online when it comes to regulating yourself? Like, you talked a little bit about that, about like when you have experienced being called out or called in for something you said or done, that it feels really bad. How do you kind of bring that into your online interactions?
Right. I want to preface this by saying I have, reiterating, I guess, that I have a lot of privilege. For me, personally, I try to give people the best faith read I can, you know, and if they said something, I kind of think, oh, their heart was probably in the right place. You know, I really try to work with that idea that, you know, maybe they didn't realize how they came across or what they said that could have been problematic, and to assume the best I can about people, while at the same time not begrudging anyone who doesn't do that. Folks who are angry because they've spent a lifetime dealing with microaggressions and here's one more. Mm-hmm. You know, I may be able to say, hey, you probably didn't mean that in a really nice way, but it is not incumbent upon anybody else to do that for me or for anyone else. That, you know, so one of the sort of hardest things is I'll post something like what you're talking about, or what you've been talking about, and someone will step in it, and it'll be a friend I know, and they'll get a little roughed up by, and I don't want to center them too much, the folks who they've hurt will take umbrage with what they've said and point out that it's problematic. And it can be tough to watch a friend kind of take the brunt of a bad faith read or get called out or something like that. But for me, one of the most important things is kind of stepping back and letting that happen, unless I notice whatever dynamic it is has gotten, you know, full on abusive. Hmm. But I think that can be really important, is to read with the best faith and be okay with the fact that, with knowing that not everyone else is. So when you're writing, you know, you try extra hard to articulate what you're saying, I guess.
No, it's very good advice. I agree. Like that, actually thinking about the people on the other side.
Yeah.
And you don't know who's going to be reading it, depending on how public. And that comes to a piece about personal responsibility. You're in an interesting situation and that you have a very large internet following.
Yeah.
And what you were saying earlier about like not exactly being famous, and then because of the internet, again, that's like a weird situation that a lot more people are in these days, where you are internet famous, and that yeah. It's a level of fame. And what that does to your personal responsibility, or how that shifts your personal responsibility.
Yeah.
What kind of things have you learned about that in that space? Like, you have been given a voice, right? I mean, because fame is not something that you don't choose fame. It happens to you.
Right. This is one of my, I guess, more profound personal struggles. I can really be affected by how difficult a post can become. You know, if it goes viral, if my friends are having a fight in the comments or something like that, that is a difficult thing for me. And I don't normally, like I said, I try to limit myself to kind of the 101 stuff, you know, hip checking, dude bros and things like that. And I tend to sort of stay out of the discourse, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly listen to that and read about it. But, you know, obviously things still happen and it can be really difficult for me. There's actually, I think it's from the Talmud, a quote about the world's grief.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let me poke a thing here. I think I can pull it up. Yeah, here it is. This has been bringing me a lot of, because I also sort of acknowledge a responsibility to use the platform that I have for something good, while at the same time acknowledging that I'm not a full-fledged, full-time social justice activist, and part of my audience would kind of go away if I were screaming about that all the time. So I sort of feel like I'm threading that needle a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, here's the quote, and you probably recognize it right away. It's, "Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justly now, love mercy now, walk humbly now. You are not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it." And for me, that has been, those words have been sort of a source of comfort, because there's, obviously, and particularly this last year, you know, since the election, there has been so much going on that you could just get overwhelmed with it. And trying to counter every hate group and stupid post and things like that.
Mm-hmm. What you're saying about, you've got this sense of responsibility because of the following that you have now.
Right.
But at the same time, you put yourself out there as a writer. Not that you can't do great social action work through writing, but like that's what you were driven to do and why you put yourself out there.
Yeah.
And so there's that, with great power comes great responsibility.
Right. No, and I absolutely, like, this is one of the more complicated emotional, I don't want to say interactions because it's with myself, but things going on with me right now, like figuring out, because it's only been the last year or two that things have really gotten weird as far as internet followings and things like that. And trying to figure out how I'm going to handle what's going on and things like that. That has, you know, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but like, I've spent some time in therapy talking about this, you know. This is a real personal conflict for me, is kind of how to thread this needle right now and deal with my feelings of responsibility and also my limitations and self-care.
Yeah, no, that's a big piece. Self-care is such a... I don't think you can be called to any kind of action or awareness without realizing very quickly that self-care is a big part of that.
Right.
For you, what are the things that you've learned, routines of self-care, aspects of self-care that are really essential?
Yeah. Some of the more pragmatic ones are, I'm really quite a bit better at handling volatile internet interactions earlier in the day. By the end of the day, I'm kind of a little bit worn and my patience is not where it was. And if I'm not careful, I might say something I don't really mean. Days off are pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of this is, again, one more aspect of privilege. You know, I have the privilege of pulling back and not dealing with racism or sexism and letting myself rejuvenate. And I think it's important to acknowledge that. Another thing that I've noticed is pretty important is titration with my normal writing, with my more humorous writing, blog stuff, and posts about how my day is going or taking selfies at Five Guys or something, you know, balancing that. Because I can get really wrapped in when something's happening and I'm posting about it a lot, and then all of a sudden I'm thinking about it all the time, and then it really picks up and dominates my thoughts, and it's not good for my thinking. It kind of takes over everything, and I get a little lost in that, and I start to notice I'm not as good at things like giving people full faith readings and trying to substitute kindness instead of anger and things like that.
Mm. Yeah. So, I mean, it resonates. Like, I think it's like working with that guilt feeling about not doing enough when you see that there's so much that needs to be done.
Yeah.
My practice around that one is just to remind myself that it's really arrogant to think I'm supposed to solve all the world's problems.
You know, a lot of my, a lot of my, my best thinking solutions to downward spiral thinking like that is to point out what you're actually thinking is a little egotistical. like you're going to fix this problem or something like that. So yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's a good humbling practice. And then
yes.
It reminds you of what you are capable of. Because I can say, honestly, the stuff that you shared has totally made a direct impact in my life and been really helpful. And there's sometimes when, even if it's not something I'm going to use later, just seeing you write it, I'm like, oh, I have faith. Because there are white dudes who are doing the work. There's one now.
That is really amazing to hear. Thank you so much.
I mean, I feel the benefit, and I think it's important to share that. And I often feel that we are not very good about sharing our appreciation for the significance of the impact for something that's actually very small, right? Like, it doesn't take much. And what you're saying about just like coming back to it over and over again and looking at it, and you said, you know, 10 years ago, your responses would have been so different.
Yeah.
And I have to say, just 10 years seems like a pretty impressive turnaround to go from being a dude bro to being like the white guy I wish I had in my pocket when I get in uncomfortable conversations about sexism. So what resources or guidance could you offer to listeners as support for doing this kind of personal and public work? And I think specifically, like, what would you say to those dude bros who are starting this process of waking? I like using waking instead.
Right.
Got that from a Radical Dharma talk. It was great. So yeah, what resources or guidance can you offer to listeners?
Well, there are obviously, a few canonical works like Unpacking the Knapsack of Privilege and things that would be great resources. But I'm not really 100% sure there's any one book or resource or website or anything that's really going to knock someone out one way or the other. I think for me, I tend to read a lot anyway. So one of the things that I really tried to do was just follow or friend, I'm talking mostly on Facebook at this point, That's where I do a lot of online activity. But whatever social media is going on, kind of follow or friend people who are involved in these struggles directly. And whenever they point at something, hey, this person gets it, or particularly when they write something themselves, I read it, you know, and I try to get a sense of it. And I don't know that it's, I have no personal problem reading 20 or 30 articles a day on social justice, but I know that would be a lot for most people, you know, but I think finding, you know, when I can't do all the articles in the world, one of the things I can do is say, oh, look, four people have shared this. It must be good. And use a broad friend group as a little bit of a litmus test for what I definitely need to be taking a look at. I think for other people, you know, that would just be an important part of the process, is to listen to folks, really listen, really try to apply the empathy, calm that part of their mind that is immediately skeptical and immediately wants to find the holes in the logic, and just listen and take in what they're saying. And after a while, you start to hear the refrains and the parts of these stories that are similar across hundreds and thousands of people. And it's just impossible to realistically suggest that they all are like exaggerating in exactly the same way. Like, that's just absurd, you know?
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
CRISPR Keen is a writer and owner of the blog Writing About Writing. He's currently working on a crowdfunded book series. You can learn more about his work and connect with Chris through his website, crisperkeen.com. That's BRECHEEN. To find out more about my work in the world, to get in touch with me, or to become a patron, visit CaitlinSCHatch.com. The link is in the show description. This episode of Everything is Workable was made possible through the patronage of Gretchen Wagner, Julian and Shannon Hatch, Winita Budgen, and Margaret Prescott. Thank you to Tejai Moore of More Music for the original theme song.